It is Friday, October the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, the latest on the missing Saudi journalist and what the U.S. is doing about it.
Well, it'll have to be very severe. I mean, it's bad stuff. But we'll see what happens.
Delayed Afghan elections set now for Saturday.
There is a lot of concern. There's no doubt about it. The security situation is not very good, and there are quite a large number of candidates.
Also ahead, the plight of African migrants trying to reach Europe, plus the sounds of Ray Charles. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump says it certainly looks, in his words, as though a missing Saudi journalist is dead. We get more now from AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
President Trump doesn't say what led him to conclude that Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi is dead, but he does say it would be bad for the Saudis if they're found to have been involved.
Well, it'll have to be very severe. I mean, it's bad stuff. But we'll see what happens.
Trump adds he will respond based on the various investigations.
We're waiting for the results of about three different investigations, so we should be able to get to the bottom.
Officials in Turkey say Khashoggi was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul by members of an assassination squad with ties to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudis have dismissed those reports. Tim McGuire, Washington.
And before President Trump spoke to reporters about Khashoggi, the administration announced that Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin had pulled out of a major upcoming Saudi investment conference, and a U.S. official said that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had warned the Saudi Crown Prince that his credibility as a future leader is at stake. Pompeo spoke after meeting in Riyadh.
We made clear to them that we take this matter with respect to Mr. Khashoggi very seriously. They made clear to me that they, too, understand the serious nature of the disappearance of Mr. Khashoggi. They also assured me that they will conduct a complete, thorough investigation of all of the facts surrounding Mr. Khashoggi and that they will do so in a timely fashion.
Pompeo said the Saudis should be given a few more days to make their public investigation before the U.S. decides how or if to respond. President Trump's comments about Khashoggi's disappearance and possible murder signaled an urgency in completing that probe. VOA's Lori London asked Robert Dietz, a George Mason University scholar and former special counsel for the U.S. National Security Agency, for his read on the amount of time the U.S. is giving the Saudis to complete their so-called investigation.
In my view, and this is just my analysis of what's going on here, is something that's happened in the past where we give a malefactor time, a malefactor who's a national leader, time to find a fall guy, of somebody to take responsibility. And this fall guy will be identified as a rogue, somebody working outside his authority on behalf of the kingdom. And the time Secretary Pompeo is giving them is time for them to cook their story. That's my best guess.
Why would the U.S. be so seemingly complicit that they are working with the Saudis to come up with a story rather than getting to the actual truth of something that seems just so horrific?
I never said they were complicit or working with the Saudis. I suspect the time is being given to Saudis for them to work up the story. And I think the easy answer to that question is that we need Saudi Arabia. Yes, they need us, but we need Saudi Arabia. We need them as a counterweight to Iran. I mean, that's been sort of American doctrine for many, many years, well, ever since the Shah left. If Saudi Arabia is somehow cut off by us, I mean, for example, trying to organize boycotts of their oil, we cannot have boycotts of both Iranian and Saudi oil. The other nations in the world are going to say, wait a minute, what do you expect us to do without oil? And so, you know, if we're going to have a boycott of Iranian oil, we cannot boycott Saudi oil. In addition, Saudi Arabia buys enormous quantities of American arms hardware, you know, jets and other kinds of weapons. And so I don't think we can walk away from them for this one thing, even though this one thing is quite horrendous.
You talk about arms, you know, we've heard horrors that U.S.-made weapons are contributing to in places like Yemen, which is seeing one of the worst famines in the world. People are dying. Civilians are getting killed by the thousands. We're supposed to be a leader in human rights here.
Yes.
How is our response to just basically give them a free pass? What kind of a statement is that making? Is it giving dictators around the world a license to just do the same?
No, I don't think it is. In an ideal world, of course, there would be repercussions. But this is realpolitik. You can't just ignore Saudi Arabia's position in the Middle East, in an area that is just fraught with all kinds of problems. What we do with Saudi Arabia has got to be looked in the context of trying to keep Iran in the box, trying to deal with Syria, and of course encouraging the flow of oil. It's akin to three-dimensional chess. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to do the following, and that'll solve the problem. Because if you do something, it's going to have repercussions elsewhere in the Middle East. And so, and by the way, for all our, you know, idealism and so forth, the U.S., particularly during the bad old days of the Soviet Union, supported and was kind of in bed with a lot of pretty bad characters. And the only defense was, well, they're anti-communist. Again, because we need Saudi Arabia, we can't just say the death of this one person, as horrible as it was, is going to be the lever that changes our relationship with Saudi Arabia.
And what about the Crown Prince, and what about all these videos showing these suspects that apparently had very close ties to him? How do they get past that, trying to say that this was a rogue situation that they didn't know about, when you've also got one of the close associates, the forensic expert within the Saudi government, showing up with a bone saw?
Agreed. To my mind, what's going on is akin to a dance, and people understand the steps to the dance. The Saudis will come up with a story that most of us will look at and say that's completely implausible. Our president and other national leaders in Europe will accept it because that's how the dance operates. But nobody deep down is going to say, oh, yeah, that sounds like exactly what happened. Moreover, I suspect that in accepting this whatever story is cooked up, the U.S. and other leaders of other nations will have a serious talk with the Crown Prince and possibly the King and say, look, you got a free pass on this one, but you can never, ever do this again. You've got to get the Crown Prince. You've got to keep him in the box.
Robert Dietz is a George Mason University scholar, former special counsel to the U.S. National Security Agency. We should note at this point that U.S. lawmakers are condemning the Saudis and questioning the seriousness with which President Trump and his top aides are dealing with all of this. While the president has emphasized that billions of dollars in weapons sales to the Saudi Arabians is up for grabs, and it's coming from the United States. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. The race is on. A preview of the 2018 U.S. midterm elections. What's at stake for the country as energized Democrats try to win enough seats to control the House of Representatives? We discuss it all with our veteran political analysts, John Fortier and Jim Kessler. An update on U.S. politics this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. European Union leaders took stock of progress being made on stemming the flow of migrants from Africa to Europe during their meeting this week in Brussels. They noted that there had been a significant decrease in migrant arrivals from the eastern route, from Libya across the Mediterranean to Italy. However, there is an increase in migrant flow on the western route, that is, across the Mediterranean, where migrants are traveling from Mauritania and Morocco to enter Europe through Spain. Another big concern was discussed is how human traffickers who are out there victimizing the migrants. VOA's Kim Lewis speaks with journalist Catherine Field, who covered the EU meeting. for the latest on the migrant developments.
The big change in focus now is the recognition that from the eastern Mediterranean, that is the area Libya, there are far fewer migrants arriving by boat into the Mediterranean and up through Italy. What is of concern now is the so-called Western Mediterranean route. That is, migrants arriving through Mauritania, Morocco, and coming into Spain. And there, over the last couple of months, you've seen an increase of about 150%. So the European Union recognizes they need to do more work there. And that would mean doing more economic programs, economic developments in those countries, strengthening food securities, and putting in infrastructure to stop, in particular, the human traffickers that are bringing those refugees and migrants along that route into Europe. Of course, what this really is just Europe putting up a big barrier once again and saying, we're going to deal with the people smugglers, we're going to increase the aid and the training that we give to maritime safety officials in that region to make sure people don't get on boats. They're looking at that again, rather than, at the moment at least, increasing aid or giving know-how for programs actually as part of their Africa Fund.
Now, a lot of the humanitarian agencies and NGOs are saying this is not the solution to the problem, that what needs to be looked at are the root causes of migration in the first place. Is anyone looking at this?
They're looking at it, but they're having trouble getting the money for that. You're quite right. You've got the EU Emergency Trust Fund for Africa, and that is the one that's meant to address the root causes of mass migration, the whole reason for why there is this forced displacement. So there is talk about that, but they are having trouble getting more funding for that. And again, because the numbers of migrants are down, numbers arriving in Europe are well down from previous years. So far this year, there's only been about 110,000 arriving in Europe. So in lots of ways, it's gone off the agenda. And there's really been a feeling that, well, putting up this big barrier across northern Africa has worked.
Also, what is the situation regarding Libya at this time?
The European Union particularly seems to feel that this has so far been a success, that they are helping to work with the Libyans to bring their country not so much into a situation whereby they can really invest there, but that they are focusing on the political process and the stability of Libya and the economic situation there. They already are going to have quite a high-level meeting on Libya, which will take place in Italy next month. So what they really want to do there is have a look at the economic situation and, wherever possible, try and usher in some sort of situation whereby your presidential and parliamentary elections could take place.
That is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
In other news that we're following, a shooting incident took place during the visit of a top U.S. general in Afghanistan. We get more now from AP's Kathy Gannon.
According to the Taliban, who took responsibility, the target was the U.S. commander in charge of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, General Scott Miller. General Miller escaped unhurt, but the three top officials in Kandahar, the police chief, the governor himself, and the head of the intelligence for the province, were all killed, as was a Afghan corps commander.
The shooting took place only a day or so before nearly 9 million Afghans will be going to the polls. That'll happen Saturday. It's a delayed parliamentary election. Several of the hundreds of candidates competing for various offices have been killed so far, and hundreds of polling stations closed as the Taliban insurgency attempts to intimidate voters from casting ballots. They have attacked and killed scores of security force members in recent weeks, and there's also concern over the potential for large-scale fraud. This is the first parliamentary election since 2010. More than 2,500 candidates are contesting 249 seats in the lower house of parliament. More than 400 of them are women. The ballot is seen as a key vote ahead of next April's presidential contest. Indiana University scholar Nazif Shahrani is in Kabul and spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the pre-election atmosphere.
There is a lot of concern. There's no doubt about it. The security situation is not very good, and there are quite a large number of candidates, both in urban environments and also in the rural areas, in the provincial centers. Some areas of the country, of course, are not going to have any participation in the elections because those are under Taliban control. The rest is under threat. And there are a lot of concerns also about the possibility of this being fair and non-interference from either people with illegal armed groups or the Taliban. The environment is rather tense. But Kabul, at least, is very, very lively in terms of campaigning posters, if nothing else. Television stations or even phones. People get on their phones and from candidates to vote for them and so on. There's both excitement as well as a lot of concern.
How important is it that this election go off for perhaps even the peace process or the direction of the war?
I think the expectation is the outcome will be quite contested and there will be charges and countercharges of all sorts. How they're going to sort that out, that is who will be declared winners. You remember in the last parliamentary elections, Karzai eliminated 60-something elected in the first round, and then others were added on. So we don't know. I think the outcome is going to be not decided on Saturday or even, you know, a week after that or maybe longer. The important role of this particular elected parliament will be, if it's going to happen, would be constitutional amendment. They will be the critical element of the Luya Jirga, the constitutional amendment and changes body, which will include them and then the Senate, and also some representatives will be coming from the districts across the country, which also are having their district council elections. And members of that particular district council will contribute numbers to the Luya Jirga for the constitutional amendment, which has been in the picture for, in fact, it was part of the agreement between Ghani and Abdullah to happen within the 2 years of their administration, but it has not happened, and it's not going to happen during their tenure anyway. Whatever the makeup of this particular parliament, they will have a role in making it, first of all, possible for the constitutional Luya Jirga to take place, and then if it takes place, how that amendment process will happen.
Afghans are literally risking their lives to cast votes.
There is no doubt about that. Also, candidates are risking their lives. So far, I think there have been maybe half a dozen or more candidates who have been assassinated for varieties of reasons, and people who are going to be voting will also be risking to some extent their lives to vote.
That is Indiana University scholar Nazif Shahrani. He's in Kabul, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Archaeologists conducting a dig at an ancient Italian cemetery have found the skeletal remains of a 10-year-old child that suggested a so-called vampire burial. The remains included a skull with a rock intentionally placed into the mouth in what was described as a possible religious or superstitious effort to prevent the deceased from rising from the dead. According to the researchers, the cemetery where the remains were found was used to bury babies and young children back in the 5th century. It's thought that the youngsters may have died in an outbreak of malaria that swept the Italian region of Umbria at that time. The archaeologists say that they believe placing the stone into the child's mouth may have been part of a funeral ritual designed to contain the disease as well as the body itself. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello, and I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell, you think you know me well, but you don't know me.
Ray Charles was an American singer-songwriter, musician, and composer. Among friends and fellow musicians, he preferred being called Brother Ray and was often referred to as the genius.
Oh, I'm just a friend. That's all I've ever been. 'Cause you don't know me.
Ray Charles, who was blind from the age of 7, pioneered the soul music genre during the 1950s by combining blues, R&B, and gospel styles into his music. He also contributed to the integration of country music, rhythm and blues, and pop music during the 1960s with his many crossover successes like You Don't Know Me, a song written by country superstar Eddie Arnold. Another huge fan favorite was I Got a Woman.
Well, I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman way over town, good to me. Oh, yeah. She give me money when I'm in need. Yeah, she's a kind. For me, oh yeah, she says loving early in the morning just for me, oh yeah, she says loving just for me, oh she loves me so tender.
Ray Charles became friends with record producer, musician, and film producer Quincy Jones. Their friendship lasted until the end of Charles's life. It was Quincy who encouraged Ray to sing his big hit, Georgia on My Mind.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me. Other eyes smile tenderly. Still in the peaceful dreams I see, the road leads back to you. I said, Georgia.
In 2002, Rolling Stone ranked Ray Charles number 10 on the list of the 100 greatest artists of all time. Musicologist Henry Pleasant said Ray possessed one of the most recognizable voices in American music. And America meant a lot to Ray Charles, who took every opportunity to sing his favorite patriotic song, America the Beautiful.
Oh, beautiful. world for heroes proved in liberating strife. Who more than self their country loved?
Even with his substance abuse and legal issues, so many people loved Ray Charles. He was married twice and had 12 children with 10 different women. He died at his home in Beverly Hills, California, of complications resulting from acute liver disease on June 10, 2004, at age 73. He was surrounded by family and friends.
Singing something like this. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain.
Absolutely, no doubt. A very distinctive voice. One of my favorites, Ray Charles. Hey, listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Ray Charles.
I'm talking about America. Sweet America.
This is Today in History. On November 19, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln delivered one of the most famous speeches in American history at the dedication of the Military Cemetery at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Lincoln's 10 sentences received little attention at first, but northern newspapers took note of their powerful message in which he articulated the meaning of the U.S. Civil War. On this day in 1887, fictional detective Sherlock Holmes made his debut in A Study in Scarlet, a story written by British physician Conan Doyle. Specializing in solving unusual cases using his extraordinary powers of observation and logical reasoning, Sherlock Holmes would appear in 4 novels and 56 short stories. On this day in 1942, the Soviet Red Army launched a huge counteroffensive against German troops that turned the tide in the Battle of Stalingrad and eventually in the war between Germany and the Soviet Union. And on this day in 1961, record industry history was made when Chubby Checker's original hit song, The Twist, re-entered the charts on its way to becoming the first record to reach number one for a second time. The Twist reached the top position in 1960, but Checker's appearance on the popular Ed Sullivan Show pushed it back onto the charts. Chubby Checker was born Ernest Evans, but the wife of TV host Dick Clark suggested the name Chubby Checker as a takeoff on then-popular singer Fats Domino. The name stuck, and Chubby Checker and his dance craze, The Twist, became a part of music history. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.